Well, now I'd like to spend some time with you looking at what is humility in the New Testament generally, in James particularly. Okay, so that's our topic for the rest of this half. It's a very beautiful topic and quite obviously an important one. If we want to know what humility is in the New Testament, we go to Jesus, of course. And here we have this beautiful text, Matthew 11, 28 to 29, where Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy burdened, and I'll give you rest. Learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart." Humble in heart. So it's a heart quality. What is it? What is it to be humble? Firstly, just to put it into a setting, I'll talk with you briefly, and again, this is my thoughts, I suppose. I've no doubt got them from somewhere over my life of reading, but I only offer them to you as a suggestion. Different levels of pride that we'll be aware of, and you can make sense of it or improve it, obviously, for yourselves. Starting from the least problematic pride, and I've got four lists here to suggest, because this is the opposite of humility. And often when you see the opposite, it's easier to see what we're talking about. There's the first pride, the most common pride in our world, and we're all a bit infected by it probably, is when you're proud of external things. Beauty. Beauty can be quite external. The shape of the jaw, the high cheekbones or the low cheekbones. If you're in some countries, plenty of fat is a sign of beauty. In others, the nearer you are to being anorexic, the more beautiful you are. Like it all, it's all rather silly stuff. Usually male-dominated stuff too. But all, you know enough about all that. So one takes pride in one's appearance. So a lot of money goes into it, a lot of advertising goes into it. And those of you who are in love with anybody else know that their beauty is in their soul, in their eyes, in their manner, in their listening, in their caring. And the most beautiful people in the world mightn't get onto the front page of any of these stupid magazines, but you know they're beautiful. And I hope they know it. So, beauty, wealth. Okay, nothing wrong with any of these things, by the way. But they're not what we value. They're not the primary value. Status, honours, reputation, all of these things. And often it's only when they're, well, I found this a bit, it's only when something's attacked that we often realise how much value we put in it. I won't go into this at great length, but I would have thought that I didn't care about my reputation very much, and I don't think I do, you know. I mean, I do what I do, and if okay, it didn't seem to work. But when my reputation was really attacked, I realised, my God, it does matter to me, you know. But I didn't know, because I mean, if everybody likes you, basically, you don't realise it. So, and that's often people, and when you're wealth, anything like this happens, you realise you're putting a lot of basis on it that you didn't perhaps know. Well, that's a form of pride. Not a terrifically harmful form of pride, usually, because everyone sees through it. Except yourself, and you don't get far with it anyhow. And unless someone's as silly as you, they're not going to marry a young boy because he's got a fast car. Unfortunately, some might. But wouldn't it be good if they actually got to know the boy? But that's why parents and grandparents have a lot of pain, because immature people can be caught up in this. Another worse form of pride is a pride based on power. Such pride can lead to a refusal to submit to appropriate authority. There is authority in our world that is appropriate, but we won't submit to it. We like to exercise power rather than accept it. An exaggerated self-confidence. Some temperaments go that way. I think mine heads in that direction. Other people don't seem to have much trouble with this. They're very unself-confident and they need building up. It just depends on your history. Self-sufficiency. A lot of training. I don't know about women, I won't go into that, but men often were trained to be pretty self-sufficient. And men, clerical men like me, priests, subtly, a whole lot of training went in to make us pretty self-sufficient, probably just as well, because you have to be pretty self-sufficient, but I'm just pointing out the dangers, you know? Self-complacency, a false sense of independence and at times a dominating ambition. That can affect people. So blind to it, but it's a form of pride, because actually we're all just like autumn leaves, really, pushed around by the wind, and we all belong together. There's not much to any of us. There's a lot to each of us too, but we belong together. And this kind of vaulting ambition stuff is pride. Humility is going to be something that frees us from all this. Everything we are and everything we have is a gift, so what on earth are we doing dominating other people for it? And some of you in the workplace may have suffered. I've never suffered from this because I'm not in the workplace in a way. People call what I do work, but I don't know why. You know, it's not paid and it's not inflicted and it's what I want to do and all that. But how many people have that privilege is another matter. So in the ordinary workplace where you need a job and get a job and are paid for the job and can't not do it, even if you don't want to do it, sometimes, that can be pretty tough, can't it? This domination by other people who are above you in the workplace. A third form of pride, and we're getting worse, I've only got four, so cheer up, is intellectual pride. This is pretty rampant. The pride of refusing to accept or trust anything that fails to make sense to my own overrated intellect. Some of you may never have had this problem. But if ever you've been trained in any particular area or see yourself as having some expertise in the area, this can come in and eat away at what you're doing. I see in the public world sometimes, people whom I won't mention names here, of course, but people whom I actually admire their mind. They've got a very good mind and they often have say things that I think, yeah, he's got words that I can use. But they, for example, poo-poo the existence of God, say. And what's happening there, it's very tragic. I'd like to meet these people and talk with them because I think what they're doing is they've become so confident in their brilliance and their perspicacity and all that that they, if something doesn't come onto their radar screen, they say it doesn't exist. Or if something doesn't fit within that world that they're very good in, instead of wondering about it and leaving it alone even, they won't have it in. And of course, as I don't have to teach this to you, but if you deny the existence of the God of Jesus, you will invent a God, and that God will be a lot, lot, lot worse. It might be your own ego, it might be nationalism, it might be anything at all. It might be money, it might be power, it could be anything. But you'll have a God, don't worry. Your God is the one that can be discovered by looking at when you ultimately make decisions, what is the criteria you use? That's your God. Well, the final one is spiritual pride. Here. And this is rather well put by a Carmelite priest, French priest, who goes under his religious name is Marie Eugène. And he wrote a double volume book on Teresa of Avila, and I've never seen it put better than this. This is the worst form of pride. I pray you're free from it, or if you ever find bits of it, it's well worth confessing. And temptation comes subtle and unawares. It comes almost necessarily, so tenacious is pride. The soul uses these spiritual riches to exalt itself and attract notice, to serve a need for affection or for domination, or simply to make its personal ideas triumph. One's personality, idolatrous of self, is substituted for God, and what is received to be used as an instrument and a means is used to impose itself. This is pride in the gifts that God has given you of the Spirit. Someone might have a very special gift of healing, let's say. And if you have this special gift of healing, that's a beautiful thing. But you don't talk about it. You don't feel better than others because of it. You don't push yourself with it, of course. But some people do. So that a gift given by God for a spiritual purpose becomes an ego-bolstering thing. Forgetting. I mean, you can see how terrible that is, I'm sure. A person might have any kind of special gift from God. We've all got special gifts from God. I have some gift to be able, because I've done it all my life, I can spend anything I can do, but I have some gift for teaching a bit, you know, or some gift for finding words when I work at it, for preaching. Wouldn't it be terrible if I don't think I do this, I'm not aware of it, but if I took that as, you know, reflecting, can you see how awful that would be? You'd be, it's okay to recognize the gift, but to recognize it humbly and pray for it, and use it is one thing, but to actually take pride in it, okay, it's very shockingly dangerous stuff, and we could all be guilty of this, please God not, but it's worth watching very carefully. And of course, when you see someone who has a special gift and they are pushing themselves forward because of it, you realize, well, anyone with discernment would be very, very wary of such a person. You know, you'd be very careful to not encourage. Am I being too hard, or do you follow my meaning? Now we come then. If they're the forms of pride that can attack us, and there would be others, they're the four I can think of. That tells you a little bit about myself. So if they're the forms I can think of, well, you think of yours too. What is humility? I've given you the English spelling there of the Greek word used in the New Testament. In our text in James, he's simply using the word tapenos, which means low. This is the noun tapenophrosune, which James doesn't actually use. But I'm taking you through into humility since he's just mentioned it. First of all, outside the Bible, in the Greek world, the Greek non-Jewish, non-Christian world, it was obviously an undesirable thing to be low. You want to be high, not low. It's an evil fate to be reduced to being low by others. A person who is a high position gets humiliated and pushed down to the bottom. Well, no one wants that, and it's an awful thing to have to happen, of course. However, the Greek world recognized that one is necessarily low in relation to the gods, the Olympic gods, they're high, and we human beings are only human. They weren't that silly. So they recognized that. And to reject that, one's fate as a mortal, the gods, what defined a god was the immortality. The gods didn't die, whereas we do. To forget that and have hubris, pride beyond one's human thing, of course they recognized that pride was not a good thing. But neither was being low. The aim of life is to... Now, in the first century, after Paul, so in the latter part of the first century, we find this noun, tapenophrosune, humility, used, the only places I've been able to find it are in Plutarch, Epictetus, and Josephus. But whenever they use the word humility, it's always a vice. It's never a virtue. It's best translated low-minded, small-minded, mean-spirited. It's the equivalent of having a low self-esteem, really. That's what it is. And that's not a good thing to have, as we'd agree. So, okay, looking at the Greek world generally, not the Jewish or Christian world, but the Greek world generally, even when the word humility is used, it's considered a terrible thing to be. You're supposed to have a good self-esteem. You're supposed to aspire to be great, not little. You're not supposed to be down on yourself. True. But yourself is the big thing. And by the way, this is coming back. I mean, this is very much coming back into our culture. The adoration of the self today, if you look at the public media and the advertising, the self would seem to be so important. People are trained then to project themselves, to appear well, to present well. Nothing wrong with these, by the way, necessarily. But who's taking the trouble to help people be well rather than present well? And when someone comes along for an interview and presents well, and you see that they're not well, you don't give them the job if you've got any brains, because they've learnt the techniques, but they haven't got the substance. So our world is often not into substance. It's often into, I'm being hard on my world, but that's the way I see it, into appearances, seducing us all into appearing rather than nurturing the soul and the person and whatever. So that's the Greek world generally, and I think that's accurate enough. The Jewish world, the Greek in the Jewish world, was pretty well in agreement. But that was for them too. If you had wealth, it was a sign of God's blessing. If you were poor, then you must have done something wrong. If you were well, healthy, then God is blessing you. And this came right through, by the way. This was one of the big problems of the Renaissance and the Reformation period, really. God is kind of rewarding those who are doing well. I mean, it's bizarre. But that idea was there. However, what the Jewish world added to this concept was an extraordinary insight. Namely, because of the Exodus, because we were slaves and God redeemed us, God had a special predilection for those who were low, tapenos, broken, afflicted, poor, all those words. That's new in the world, because all the other religions, God was always the God of the rich, mighty, powerful, and those who were running the show, like the Pharaoh or whoever. The fact that God could be the God of the slaves was just a stupidity, but not in Judaism. Here's Isaiah 49:13. Sing for joy, O heavens, and exult, O earth. Break forth, O mountains, into singing, for the Lord has comforted his people and will have pity on his, literally, tapenoi, low ones, the ones who are lowly, translated here, afflicted. But the word is tapenos, lowly. Ben Sirach, writing a couple of hundred years in the wisdom literature just before Jesus, chapter 2. Those who fear the Lord keep their hearts prepared and bow down their souls in God's presence. They go down recognizing the might and wonder of God. And it's a good thing to do, to bow down in God's presence. Here's Jesus, Matthew 23:12, perfectly consistent with this, when he says, if you raise yourself up, this is the same as James in our text, if you notice, if you raise yourself up, you will be bowed down. You'll be humbled, it's often translated. I'm keeping it very literally, bowed down, tapeno. If you bow yourself down, you will be raised up. Now I'm finished the Old Testament for you with this one. There are two texts, and only two texts, in the whole of the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures, prior to Jesus, where the text goes further than to talk about being low. Lowly. And it starts edging towards this humility thing. Here in Proverbs chapter 29, verse 23, they use the verb, not the noun humility, but the verb to be humble, which is tapenophroneo, See, the essence of humility is not being low, it's thinking of yourself as low. Phrena is the mind, the brain. So it's tapeno frozune is the thinking of yourself as low, which of course the Greeks thought was absolutely hopeless and quite unmanly and all that. No, Proverbs says, a man's pride will bring him low, but the one who is lowly in spirit, thinking of himself this way, seeing himself as lowly, will obtain honor. And more beautifully and quite perfectly, in the psalm we had yesterday at Mass, in fact I preached on this topic yesterday before I was aware that I was going to speak on it today, because it comes into here as well. Here's our lovely psalm, Psalm 131 in the Hebrew, but in the Greek I'm giving it to you here, which is Psalm 130, because the word doesn't occur in the Hebrew text. It's only in the Greek that you find the word humility used here, or the verb, rather, from which humility comes. O Lord, my heart is not lifted up. My eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. And now, again, only in the Greek Old Testament. You don't find it in the Hebrew. But in the Greek you find, I think of myself humbly. Tepeno phroneo, the verb. When I think of myself, I recognize that I'm only little. I think of myself that way. I have lifted up my soul like a child quieted at its mother's breast. Like a child that is quieted is my soul. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth forevermore. So the psalmist thinks of himself as a little child with his mother, with God, really. Happy to be small because God is big. Happy to be low because God will lift me up. Now the New Testament, and a couple more thoughts. Here's Jesus in chapter 18, picking up Psalm 131, giving you the normal numbering from the Hebrew text and in your own Bibles. In Matthew 18, here's Jesus saying, the disciples came to Jesus and said, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? So Jesus called a little child to him, whom he set among them, and he said to them, in truth I tell you, unless you become like a little child, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. And so the one who lowers himself, tapenos, the one who, here it is again, lowers himself like the little child, is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. The word humility, technically so-called, tapeno frozune, the noun that describes this quality, is invented, it seems, by Paul the Apostle. I've been unable to find, and I've searched, I can assure you, thoroughly, and no one's shown me any other place, I've been unable to find this noun used in Greek prior to the New Testament, which is saying something quite extraordinary. It is saying that this virtue is so special to Christianity, no one thought of it as a virtue. It's only because of Jesus that we could even think of having this virtue, because he thought of himself. When he said, Jesus, who are you? His first thoughts were Abba of the Father. He thought he was humble in heart. So he showed us a way of being human that is really so countercultural then, and it's countercultural again today. Here's Paul. We'll go to the earliest of his letters here, Colossians. As God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, clothe yourself with compassion, kindness, humility, and to know what any of these means, you have to look at Jesus, of course, meekness and patience. To my knowledge, the earliest time the word humility has occurred in the Greek language is here. Ephesians, written a little bit later. I beg you, lead a life worthy of the calling to which you've been called. With all, and the first virtue he picks out, Paul, in this beautiful letter, is humility and gentleness, the two words used in Matthew's Gospel about Jesus' heart. In all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, making every effort to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. And then in one of his last letters from prison in Rome, in humility, regard others as better than yourselves. Let the same mind be in you as was also in Christ Jesus. So the world has learnt a new virtue by watching Jesus, and it's called humility. Peter uses it, and you find it also in the Acts of the Apostles. I quoted this to you, some of you, last night. A beautiful book on prayer. I doubt if it's available because it's so old. I just happen to have a copy, but it is a wonderful book on prayer by Anthony Bloom, who is he's got a special Russian title. He's the leader of the Russian Orthodox Church in England. So he's English, but he's the something metropolitan, I think is the term they use. And in his book, Courage to Pray, he reminds us of the origins in English of our word. The word humility comes from humus, fertile soil, capable of making good use of the rubbish that we tip into it, capable of transforming our refuse into wealth, of accepting every seed, giving it body and life, growth, without denaturing it, like the silent, creative earth we should offer ourselves to the other. And he goes on a few pages, or the next page, to say it's an attitude of self-surrender, humility, which is at the same time extremely active. Self-surrender, because like the earth, humus, we give ourselves without reserve. Active, because we're ready to respond to God's every suggestion and every call. Now, a couple of, these are my own words, really attempting to define humility as a Christian virtue. It's a Christian attitude of mind and heart that recognizes oneself as God's child, sharing the life of God's Son, and therefore living in total dependence on God. The humble person delights in this dependence. This is where true humility differs from all the false things that go under the name of humility. Some people see themselves, I go beyond what I know there, but some people might appear humble, but you know they're self-centered, they're putting themselves down. Oh no, I can't do that. No, not me. Like it's actually quite an unhealthy sense of self. If a person is really humble, they are immensely joyful. If you're not joyful, you're not humble. Sorry. Because it is immensely joyful. It's the joy of a little baby that is absolutely secure with mum. Humble means I'm only little, but mum's here, everything's fine. So I'm only little, but God is here, so it'll be okay. It's a joyful sense of it's okay to be small, it's okay to be low, like little Therese when she was a little girl in her story and she couldn't get onto the first step because her leg was too small and she's trying to lift it up and the steps were too high and her dad was up at the top of the steps. And she tried and tried and then she stopped trying and just went like that and dad came down and picked her up and carried her to the top of the steps. Of course he did. But she had to learn she couldn't do it on her own. And I have to learn that. You have to learn that. Humility is learning that. It's okay to be me because God loves me. That's humility. Knowing that God is a father, mother, and can be absolutely counted on as a source of life and love and hope. That's how Jesus was. And a person with humility is actually pretty hard to frighten, because the most you can do to such a person is crucify them. And if they're willing to be crucified, I mean, you know, that's not the end of the world for them. What are you going to threaten them with? Do not be afraid of those who take your body but cannot kill your soul. Hard as it is, but there it is. Here's the last little statement. Again, just my attempt to define it. If we're humble, we recognize that all that we are and all that we have is a gift. We're dependent upon God for everything. Of ourselves, we can do nothing. If we're humble, the above realization is a source of trust and joy. We delight that God belongs to us. We delight that we're chosen by God in love. That's our joy. Then we can get on with living all the gifts that God has given you without pride, without self-centeredness, without getting one's ego built up by it, just simply grateful. Like a flower in the field, it gives off perfume, but it's not saying, oh, you know, I'm giving off perfume. It's just giving off perfume because it's there. It's just beautiful. So unless you become as a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom. And wouldn't it be lovely if little children, who often have this little virtue, why would we lose it? Huh? Some of you might have taught primary kids, and you know, they're just really lovely, and they go into secondary school, and something, I'm not blaming secondary schools, for God's sake, I taught in them for 10 years myself, and I see wonderful work happening in them, so I'm not blaming the school, but something can happen in that age group, kind of, where you go into teenage and you become a bit insecure, and then you get all the bullying or all the thing, and then you get, which I didn't have during my teenage years. I grew up, don't want to get too personal, but I grew up presuming that Mum and Dad actually knew best. What a good presumption, because I can't remember when they didn't. So that's how I grew up. So if Mum and Dad didn't think a thing was good, none of the kids at school could tell me it was good. They were just wrong, because they're not as sensible as Mum and Dad. I think I was very fortunate, but I was also in a world where there was no television, you see. People came into our home as guests, welcomed by my parents. I had brothers and sisters, all of that. But the influence of the peer group for me, and probably for many of you, was actually not very big at all. Not a big influence at all. Whereas today it is so dominant. And the media world, knowing, this is where psychology is so beautiful but so abused. People who know that this world influences the adolescent use it knowingly to get into the weaknesses of young people and twist them. I find that diabolical, but it's all around us. And Mum and Dad have to suffer that. And there aren't any enough mums and dads joining. So humility is a lovely, if this virtue is, if a child almost has it naturally, well, wouldn't it be lovely to keep it and to develop it so that you, as whatever age you might be, are a free person, loved by God. No one can take that from you. If they can't take that from you, they can't take anything from you. And to really know, and just be yourself, and let all the bullies around the place, intellectual or otherwise, who are trying to tell me you have to be this to be successful, you have to be that to be successful, you have to have this gift, you have to look like this, you have to keep doing this, you have to... They're all wrong, so why don't we just smile at them and say, it's okay, you're doing your best, and they just move into life. One last thing while I... There are two ways of... Two important things about humility that I'm aware of, and I think this is a really important thing to say for me. One is, humility is based on self-knowledge. So we have to be, not just for humility, but for everything, we have to be reflective persons. We have to take time when we have experiences to actually hold the experience and then look inside to see where we're, who we are. Jung, of course, everyone else too, I suppose, but Jung is very strong on this, isn't he? And if something happens in my life and I react in a certain way to what you're saying or what you're doing or what's happening to me, I have to know, and by the way, many people don't know it, that I react in this way because of something in me. I could have reacted 50 ways to what you said. I could have reacted 50 ways to what you did. I could have responded, as we know, in many, many, many ways, but I actually responded this way. Why? Nothing to do with you. It's everything to do with me. I responded this way because of something in me, and the sooner I find out what that is, why do I respond this way when I'm attacked, or this way when I'm offended, or this way when people disagree with me? And surely I'm right. Nearly everybody you meet blames somebody. Oh, my parents did this, or my uncle did this, or he did that, or they take you to court, or whatever. We want to blame somebody for my reacting the way I am. They may be at fault, and what they're doing may be unjust, and we may have to take them to court, of course, because an injustice is being done. But for heaven's sake, don't let's be stupid enough to think that my reaction is caused by them, otherwise I'm just nothing. I'm a human being. I'm reacting this way. I better find out. So humility demands introspection, which demands time, which demands... And so what tendency we have, and again our culture, God, you'd think I didn't like our culture. I think it's got a lot going for it, but our culture tends to go from one thing to another, and speed and busyness and overexertion and working all the time, and there's almost a conspiracy to stop people introspecting, because if we do introspect, we won't buy. There'll be very little we'll buy because we don't actually need it. So you've got to keep catching me off guard to get me to spend, and that's what it's geared towards a lot. So it's an unhealthy situation we're in. So introspection is important, but, and this is the point I really want to make, you don't actually learn humility by introspection. Introspection is necessary to get to know myself. Please check this. I'm just giving you what I think is right. I actually only get to know myself, not by looking at myself. Because I'm still looking with my eyes. And if I don't know myself, I won't recognize myself when I look in. I learn who I am from those who love me. So we have to look out in a contemplative way. Looking out and looking in at the same time, really. So ultimately we learn humility by looking at Jesus. It's only by contemplation, by looking at the one we've pierced, by watching how Jesus responds, that I learn other ways of responding. And please God, there's someone in your life who loves you, and it's that person who loves you who will teach you humility. Because you can't have humility unless you feel loved. Can you? Because you must defend yourself. We just despair. So if there's no love around, I'm going to be desperately barricading everything. When you're loved, you can afford to let go the mask and the barricade, and people who love you will gradually teach you who you really are, so that all who you're not can fall away. And it's what Jesus taught it so beautifully, because he showed people by his loving, man on the cross, Mary of Magdala, name them all, he surprised them by love all the time. And if you're surprised by love, you know what that does to you. And acknowledging that beauty as a gift is the key. Not as something, I'm beautiful. If you're beautiful, it's because your mum loved you and your dad loved you and an uncle loved you and an auntie loved you and your wife or husband or your children. If you go for it, you know who all the people around you do. If they're loving you, that's why you're beautiful. So thank God for it, and then get on with it and be beautiful and blossom and give perfume off and